think about the life I live, a figure made of clay, and think about the things I lost, the things I gave away. And when I'm in a certain mood, I search the halls and look. One night I found these magic words in a magic book. Throw it away. You can throw it away. Give your love, live your life each and every day. And keep your hand wide open and let the sun shine through. Cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you. There's a hand to rock the cradle and a hand to help us stand, with a gentle kind of motion as it moves across the land. And the hands unclenched and open, gifts of life and love it brings. So keep your hand wide open if you're needing anything. And every day, and keep your hand wide open and let the sun shine through. Cause you can never lose a thing if it belongs to you.
Isn't that the truth? Isn't that the truth? You can't lose a thing if it belongs to you. That's the great Abby Lincoln with Throw It Away. Archie Shepp just coming in there with the sax. And later you would hear Roy Burrows on trumpet, Frederick Waits on drums, Jack Gregg on bass, and Hilton Rees on piano. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Wednesday, October the 2nd. And the madness continues in Washington, D.C. Later this afternoon at about 5:30, the president is supposed to be having a kind of confab at the White House involving the leaders of the House and the Senate. That's John Boehner, Republican in the House, Republican Speaker in the House, John Boehner, House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell. They're supposed to be huddling at 5:30 at the White House. Meanwhile, in the House, the Republicans and the Democrats are working feverishly to figure out whether there is something that they can agree on ahead of time, because right now the Republicans are advancing piecemeal solutions in anticipation of some inroad that they may have in negotiations with the White House, although officially the position of the president is there is going to be no negotiation. But at the same time, he is facing a very tough position. While there is this victory, quote-unquote, in being resolute about not negotiating, there is the matter of the $17 trillion debt ceiling that is going to have to be resolved come October the 17th. The president is expected to go abroad to Asia to confirm or reconfirm the U.S. commitment in that region, and he would be coming back. He's already shortened his stay. He'll be coming back just a few days before that October 17th deadline. The suggestion is that maybe these talks are aimed at trying to figure out whether he would have real hell on his hands when he gets back. So we'll see what happens before the end of the day. We'll get a clue as to whether any progress is made in these interim discussions at the White House this afternoon. But we are going to be returning today to the center of the debacle, which is, of course, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare. Our guest, we are very fortunate, is Dr. Vernalia Randall, Professor Emerita of Law at the University of Dayton School of Law, who was a consultant to a healthcare reform advisory committee during the Clinton administration. Dr. Randall, who has been nationally recognized for her work in eliminating racial and class disparities in healthcare, was a litigator in Portland, Oregon, specializing in healthcare and insurance law, a health administrator for the state of Alaska, an expert witness in the landmark state of Missouri versus Philip Morris trial that took on the tobacco industry, linking cigarette smoking to several serious diseases, and a former nurse practitioner herself in Seattle, Washington. She writes and lectures extensively here in the United States and abroad on women's issues and healthcare. Vernalia, it's good to have you with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Thanks. The last time we talked, we had talked about what options people had outside of the two-party system. But here we are, and I couldn't think of a person better situated to discuss what's going on now than you, because you have a vantage point from all sides. You have an administrative vantage point. You have, you know, the practical vantage point as a nurse practitioner, and you have the litigation knowledge to tell us exactly what we think. So let's start there. How are you seeing this current dilemma?
What do you mean in terms of the current dilemma? The shutdown over the Obamacare?
This whole thing about Obamacare.
Well, I mean, it's a complicated situation because it's really Obamacare is a very, very conservative approach to fixing the healthcare problems, and in fact, it doesn't really do that. It has some good points, but if you want to talk about whether or not it is a, you know, progressive, liberal, radical, even moderate approach to fixing the healthcare problems, it's none of those. It's really a conservative thing. So to the extent that the Republicans and conservatives are continuously trying to undo the bill, it really isn't about the bill. Because the features all comes from some conservative component and really doesn't take a liberal approach at all. So I think the first place to start is to say, to make sure that people understand that, the components of the bill are not at all liberal even in the approach. It maintains the a serious basis is it in the insurance industry, which we know is problematic for any kind of healthcare system. The way that all of the other capitalist countries, democratic countries, have been able to control their costs is by getting the profit out of healthcare. And Obamacare doesn't really do that really well. It really maintains the existing flawed system, just supposedly bringing more people into it.
How close, as you understand it, how closely mirrored is Obamacare to the days when you were part of an advisory committee hoping for reform during the Clinton administration?
I actually think that, and I actually wrote, not only was I an advisory committee member, I actually wrote one of the first law review papers to critique the Clinton health plan. My critique was on does the Clinton health care plan provide equality health care for poor minorities? And my answer was no. And my answer would be the same thing for Obamacare. And largely in terms of different approaches, I mean, clearly you can look at the details, but it really isn't substantially different in approach than the Clinton health care plan. It just was more about the way Obama went about it, maybe than the Clinton. I mean, you know, Clinton had this big study group and his wife was in charge of it and people. But I think that in terms of exchanges, they call them something different under Clinton, in terms of reliance on existing private insurance company, that both of the plans do that. I think that Obamacare actually probably has less coverage than the Clinton was intended to. Obamacare doesn't actually cover everyone. Even by design, it didn't cover everyone. And now, because of the way the states are implementing it, it doesn't cover everyone. So there are going to be big holes in terms of people who don't have health care because the Obamacare doesn't cover it.
Well, let me ask you to put on your legal hat here for a minute. What is, in your view, what are some of the legal shortfalls and just downright illegalities here, things that trouble you on a legal level?
Well, I mean, I guess from a legal point of view, it's really not, you know, but my view about law, which is different from a lot of point of view, is all law is values, and all law represent a group of values, and values change, and laws change because of that. So I don't find, you know, I can't argue that, oh, Obamacare is illegal. Because I don't believe that. I believe that there is a way to articulate the legality within the context of the Constitution, and I think that the Supreme Court has said that. What bothers me is that the choices that were made, supposedly what we're doing is trying to provide access to quality care and lower costs. And when you take those standards as measurements, then you have to say how well does Obamacare provide access to quality care for lower cost? Okay. And the answer is, well, first of all, without having universal health care, you're not going to be able to control the cost as well. That is the one factor that everyone in all the other countries has found out, is you have to have universal access, including anyone in your country should have access to health care if you want to control costs. When my son went to England and spent 4 years over in England, he had this problem with his toe, and he was walking around in pain. And his friend says, well, why don't you just go into the doctor? And being an American, he thought, I can't afford it. And she looked at him weird and said, well, you know, they'll see you. Go in. You don't have to have it. What happens when you don't put everyone in the system is they delay seeking care until they get so sick that they can't not seek care. So it's not – leaving people out doesn't end up not providing them care, you end up having to provide them more costly care because they wait till they're very sick to go in, okay? And so undocumented prisoners, if they're within the borders of the United States, if you want to control costs, you should have them in health care. Obamacare doesn't do that. The other problem is that if you want to provide access to care, okay, which is what they say we want to do, we're trying to provide people the access to care, you have to make sure more than they just have the ability to pay. And for the most part, although this all Obama does is say you will have insurance by requiring everybody to have insurance and by setting up these insurance exchanges. But we know, when I was a nurse practitioner, I was a nurse in Seattle in the early 70s. I ended up being one of the first nurse practitioners for a community health clinic because the community health clinic was surrounded by doctors and hospitals. This community, this low-income community, none of which would accept Medicaid. And so essentially they were in a health desert. They couldn't, you know, they could not get, so they started their own clinic. Assuring that everybody has insurance doesn't assure, one, that there's doctors in their community, or two, that the doctors will take their insurance. One of the things that I wanted to put into the law, which got I lobbied on and couldn't get anyone to take up, is to say that if doctors were taking any patients at all, they could not discriminate based on the source of your insurance. Okay? And that would then mean that you would get rid of this discrimination because it's government insurance discrimination, because it's from an exchange that they don't like. That they would, you would get rid of that insurance-based discrimination. So the problem I have with Obamacare is not about the legality of it, because I don't think that it, realistically, I don't think that that's a basis of challenge. I'm sure you can get other people who are going to argue the legality of it, but that's not my point of view. My point of view is that it may be legal, but it's just wrong. It's wrong because it doesn't really accomplish the goals that we want to accomplish. It's wrong because it's going to make it more difficult for us to accomplish those goals, because you're not going to turn over millions of people who are now going to be giving insurance company money from the taxpayer, because we're going to be subsidizing, and those insurance companies are not going to want to let loose of that the new source of money for something that's cheaper.
Well, let's look a little bit at the constitutionality of it. I know you say that doesn't particularly, for you, is not on the top of the totem pole here, but should the government be literally in the insurance business?
You know, that's not a legal issue. That's a value issue. The government should be in whatever business the government and the people of the United States deem it's going to be in. Should the government be in road business? Should the government be in fire business? Should the government be in health insurance? I mean, that's not a constitutional issue. That is a value issue. And, I mean, I can tell you my value on it, and you can get 5-10 other lawyers who tell you their value on it. And people can make arguments that may sound legal, but the reality is anything the government wants to do, it can do as long as the people let it happen. As an African American, I come from that belief because people used to be property, and it was perfectly legal. So I just don't think that's a useful argument. I think a better argument is to say, what is our value? Should the government assure universal health care? My value says yes. what is the best way to assure universal health care? Not through insurance, because you have profit in insurance, and when you have profit in insurance, you end up having to either give less services or pay more. And so my value is the government shouldn't be in this particular insurance business, because the government can provide it cheaper. The government can provide universal insurance cheaper than they can than private for profit. Medicare is a good example of that. Medicaid as well. I know that people want to go down that legal argument thing, but I think that I don't find that whole convincing.
Well, you know, it's not unusual for you to just be, you have your view, and it's not unusual for you to stick to your guns. I learned that. That's for sure. It's not unusual. What do you make of of course, this is strategy, and the Republicans and Democrats, we understand that story in the sense of, you know, both sides are at war with each other because we have issues of elections and who will control and dominate both houses of Congress. But is there a good side to the Republican opposition to Obamacare at this particular time and in the way they're doing it?
I don't think so. I mean, the thing is, if we're going to have I think it's one thing for individuals to protest the law outside the confines of, I don't want to say that people should always obey all laws. I don't believe that. I believe that individuals and groups should protest laws that they find morally reprehensible, okay? But I don't think that applies to the people who govern the country, because they are part of the process of electing laws. So any law, the thing is, we elect people who go to Congress, those people pass laws, they have a procedure, there's all kinds of ways to keep a law from passing. Most bills do not pass. And so you get this whole process of having to pass a law, then you have a president who gets to sign or veto the law, and then you have the Supreme Court who gets to say whether the law is legal or not. It seems to me that the Republicans, having lost at every single stage, is now saying we're going to use something totally unrelated as a way to block a law that we don't want to put in. And I think that's a dangerous path for us to go down. It's one thing for the people of the United States to protest. It's another thing and I think Congress people have the right to protest, but I don't think they should protest by blocking other laws that are totally unrelated. If you can't pass a bill to repeal, which is their option, that's the option they have. They can pass a bill to repeal. If they can't pass a bill to repeal, then they should proceed. But see, I take a little bit different view on what I think they're up to. I don't really think this is about Obamacare, and I know mostly – I think this is about getting concessions on Social Security. I think in the end what's going to happen is that they're going to drop the Obamacare in exchange for some type of limitation on Social Security, something Obama has been wanting to do already.
I come back to
this. And this gives him cover then to do something like that.
Your response brings me back to where you started about the conservatism of Obama as reflected in the Obamacare legislation. Ideologically, does this confirm where the party had intended to go even at the time you began your work in advising the reform-minded committee during the Clinton administration. Was the party then in transit from, did you see the exact opposite of what was professed to be a liberal view by Clinton, who was immensely popular, particularly among the populations that are most hurt, and now we have a kind of completion of that in Obamacare, the ideological shift within the Democratic Party?
I think absolutely. I think absolutely. And not just in healthcare and every. I think that what has happened, that people pay more, that people who are in the Democratic Party side of the thing like rhetoric and give their leaders leeway for whatever reason when the rhetoric doesn't match their behavior. And I think that has been going on at least since Clinton. And Clinton moved us so far to the right. Clinton moved us on the war on drugs. Clinton reformed welfare into a conservative kind of thing that attacked women and poor people. Clinton was at best a moderate in his behavior. And Obama carries on in that same tradition, but more so.
Does it boggle your mind, as it does mine, that so many African Americans are loath to criticize President Obama on the basis of that ideological shift that has, you know, paid lip service, of course, because he's an African American and people just want to see him do well. But the fact is, at ground level, much of what he is doing and has done is rooted in this notion of conservatism, the taking the party as Clinton had intended to what he called then the third way.
That's right. I'm not so much boggled by the average person on the ground, because I think that when you live in an oppressed society with white supremacy and white privilege and your day in and day out daily life of yourself and your children is to experience different type of racial oppression, then any sign of hope is clamped onto. You know, it's sort of like, oh my God, does this mean we moved? You know, so and you're just unwilling to let go of that hope in any kind of way, and because you have to then dig down into hopelessness again. I think that contributes to the average person. I think that people really feel, look, it doesn't matter, and he is at least black. If he was white, he'd be doing the same thing. So I might as well support him. He's black. Okay. What bothers me and what boggles my mind, and I still cannot get my head around them, is the intellectuals, the people who consider themselves progressive, the people who consider themselves critical race theorists, the people who have spent their whole lives saying don't analyze people as much on what they say, but the impact of their behaviors. And then look at the law, look at their behaviors, look at the impact. And then to look at Obama and not do the same thing on him, I didn't see that coming. I have been very distressed by it, because even now after 6 or 7 years, that group of people are still intellectually defending him and defending his policies. They moved from 100% to sort of, well, you know, I don't agree with everything he does, but he's done some good things. And then you try to get them to name him, and they back out of the conversation. I'm deeply concerned about what this does to our moral authority on race issues, on oppression issues, how will we regain, if how and when we will regain moral footing to challenge presidential level politics on race issues? Is this going to follow us? And maybe that's part of the intent from Obama in his campaign purpose, is this kind of undo the ability of people to challenge presidents on their racial stance. I just don't see how we're going to regain that, because the black leadership, the black intellectualship, all of those people have been at best silent and at worst complicit by articulating reasons for why what he does is acceptable.
I think that's an interesting point. The Congressional Black Caucus just concluded its annual convention, and of course they looked at literally, they were looking at the byproduct of an administration that has not delivered, and consequently we have such a huge social and economic and even political fallout. And yet there was no criticism as a whole, or to suggest that they had huge difficulties with a president who took 790 days before he met with a caucus which is representing arguably some of the most distressed communities in the United States. So what then is the work that has to be done where the African-American community, the Latino community, poor white community, their traditional spokespeople have been co-opted?
I'm at a loss to say what can be done, because this is a different age where people look to media to figure out who are the spokes leaders for these communities. And you have corporate entities who are beholden to either the Republican or Democratic Party, who put forth at the forefront people who maintain the white privilege. And so they, you know, I was saying to someone, before Obama was elected, the complaint was that they had, you know, none of these networks really had any spokespeople coming on who gave a political opinion who were people of color. Now they do, routine, regularly, talk about race and talk about different issues in the communities, but they're always people who kind of are just at best a little left of moderate. They don't actually seem to be able to bring on people who are like radical socialists who are very critical of what Obama has done. I don't know, when people pay attention to media to form their opinion about who is a leader in the community, I don't know how you restructure that when you don't have access to the media. If you go about having an organization trying to deal, I have a friend and I, what we've developed a local advocacy organization called Racial Justice Now. And tonight and tomorrow we're having a candidates forum on the school to prison pipeline, school board candidates forum tonight, and mayor and commissioners candidates forum last night. We could not get anybody to interview us ahead of time. I don't know whether they're going to show up, but they just would not interview us. I mean, we said all kinds of things about, you know, here's some statistics, look what's going on. No interview. No, this is, you know, no kind of, this is not really a story. But then they did a story last night on some mom who was making her son stand out in front of a school building because he had been suspended, and she was making him hold up a sign. So, I mean, the media controls what voices are heard and how the voices are heard. I don't know. I don't know. I wish I had the answer to that, because if I did, I would certainly engage in whatever behavior necessary to regain some our voice back for our community from the conservatives, from the Republicans and the Democrats.
Is this, too, a kind of byproduct of the very election of Barack Obama to the presidency, where the president himself on several occasions has posited or implicitly declared the end of racism and, you know, the whole phrase of the post-racial era, and in a way has served because he has been reluctant to deal squarely with the issue of race, implicitly has let stand the notion, the popular notion,
I think that's right,
that racism has come to an end.
No, I think that's right. And I think that because he lets that stand, because he, when he does talk about it, he never talks, he really kind of does that individual responsibility thing. So to whatever extent he's going to talk about race, he's going to throw some, it's going to be about, oh, we're almost there. Is it in anywhere that we haven't gone? It's really about, you know, just getting the community getting itself straight. He's gone, I mean, and he's explicitly, his people, you know, have explicitly, told people that he doesn't want race brought up. I was, you know, meetings on women's health, planning, at the White House, planning. This has been relayed to me. Planning, I wasn't there. But meetings on women's health, people kept bringing up the racial difference between black women and white women, and they were told they needed to stop that or they wouldn't be invited back.
Wow.
And so the whole thing, the meeting, the economic thing, you know, anytime there's an attempt to raise disparities, issues, whether it be educational, economic, health, the Obama administration sidesteps it and refuses to deal with it. That then empowers everyone else to sidestep it because that's what they want to do. That's what they want to do. I believe that the whole current day institutionalization of white privilege is about saying that as long as we don't talk about race and as long as we don't overtly intend to have a disparate impact, then anything we do is acceptable and okay and just unfortunate. And I think that Obama's approach has legitimized that, those thoughts.
One question before we go to listeners' questions and comments at 888-874-4888. Right now, that the saying is, in every moment of crisis, there's also a moment of opportunity. Is there opportunity for the people who will be negatively affected by Obamacare? Do they have any kind of leverage in the situation as it stands now?
You mean in terms of the shutdown or what?
In terms of the shutdown, but also in terms of their own political power at the local level to leverage the power they have, the leverage that they have is this system can't work without numbers of people registering and bringing themselves into it. Is there any room in terms of political leverage that the communities that are, in fact, the ones that have been experiencing disparities and who implicitly will continue to experience disparities, even with this new system, is there any way for them to as they say, to get a fair hearing?
I really don't know how, because they're caught between, they're caught between two almost impossible situations. The reality is if you don't have the ability to pay, that Obamacare might in fact provide you a better ability to pay, and it certainly does help the people who are insured already but who have pre-existing conditions. And so there's a segment of the community who this will benefit. And it's not the, I don't want to say that Obamacare doesn't benefit the African community at all. It does. It benefits people who have pre-existing conditions and, you know, all of those kinds of things. And so getting rid of Obamacare gets rid of those benefits. It seems to me that what's your philosophy and value? I didn't want it passed. I tend to be let things get worse kind of person, and at some point it'll get so mad that people will have to be forced to organize to do something better, okay? And if you believe that kind of philosophy, then not registering, refusing to go in would be sort of like action protest with consequences, because they're going to fine. They've got right now they have the power to fine you within the tax code, and so anyone who doesn't get insurance will end up being fined and still not have insurance. One of the things my son and I talked about is, why do this half step? Why not just say you're going to have insurance and we're going to bill you for the cost? Why all of this? We're going to fine you if you don't get it, and you know, sort of like to make it look like a false individual choice sort of thing. I don't know. See, I don't really know that within the system as it exists, Democrats and Republicans, who are both moderate and at best and conservative at worst, that protesting within this system will get them anything. I think that the opportunity may be to decide that you don't want to be a Democrat or Republican anymore, and that you're going to start working to get a third party so that there really is a choice. So, like, you know, at some point, will people see that their interests can never be served by the Democrats, can never be served by the Republicans, and that the only choice is to come up with an option, even if at the point, even if it means some pain for a while, and that would be socialist, to say that we want a socialist democratic party that and a way for that party to be able to gain some power. That's the only opportunity I see.
Well said. You're listening to Dr. Vanellia Randall, and we've been talking about Obamacare from another very different perspective. 888-874-4888 is the number to call with your questions. We'll take the short break and come back immediately after that to you. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm your Trace Lead. Our guest, Dr. Vanellia Randall, and our caller, Winston. You're up.
Hi, good evening, your Trace. Good evening,
Hello.
Doctor.
How are you?
Yes.
Good
doing
evening.
Very well, thank you. Yes, purpose of the call is, that was a very interesting take, doctor, in reference to the Republicans trying to extract some type of concession in reference to Social Security. Could you elaborate, please?
Well, everybody's been focusing on Obamacare, but the Republicans have actually thrown a whole list of stuff on the table, among which is Social Security. Obama has, for a very long time, supported some changes in Social Security. He is, I think it's called the CPI chain,
yes.
And he, in terms of how they calculate the increase in the benefits, the cost of living increase. And so my take is that we know this about Obama, that he's not a negotiator and he will give sooner or later.
Yes.
Okay. And so the question is, he's not going to give on Obamacare, and the Republicans are not going to walk away with little or nothing. What can he give on that is something that really doesn't offend him all that much because he supports it? And to me, that is Social Security.
That makes so much sense to me, Doctor. And could you promise to come back, Doctor?
If I'm invited back, I will definitely come back.
Well, gee, I don't know. Thank you. Thanks, Winston.
Having a conversation with Dutrice is a breath of fresh air.
Thank you so much, Winston.
Thank you very much.
We have Jay from New York. You're on.
Good afternoon. Hello. Good afternoon to the doctor and to you, Utrecht.
Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Based on the information that I've been hearing and I've been seeing, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever for a young person that's coming out of college with over $35,000 to $40,000 in debt that's only getting a job that's maybe paying $35,000 to $50,000 to purchase Obamacare. How would they be able to survive based on the lowest rate that they're talking about giving patients with the, I think it's bronze? It just makes absolutely no sense. They would be better off taking the penalty of, let's say, close to $100 than indebting themselves with anywhere from, I would say, $1,200 to $2,000 a year more in debt. How are they going to survive? And that's something that no one's talking about and no one's addressing. So if they figure out and they really look at the numbers, it's not beneficial to young people.
No, I think it is if they're in states where the I think it is if they can get subsidies, and the Obamacare subsidies look very good, in terms of the amount. I also have to say that not getting it is gambling. Okay, you may be coming out with a lot of debt, and this is I have a problem with it, but the reality is if you get sick, you're going to pay way more over several years than what you would if you paid insurance. So first of all, the subsidies, when you look at the rates, those are the unsubsidized rates. The subsidies for and I don't remember the exact percentage, but it's pretty high, would provide subsidies. So I think that a young person making $30,000 a year would get some subsidies from the federal government. The big problem is for the people who are in states that didn't pass the Medicaid component. And so they are not eligible for Medicaid, nor will they get any subsidies, because the subsidies are based on a certain percentage of income. So in this state, in Ohio, for instance, a single person making less than $11,000 a year, less than $11,000 a year, would end up having to pay half their income in health insurance, but that's because the conservative state refused to pass the Medicaid subsidy. If they make $11,500 $11,500 a year, $11,500 a year. They are over the poverty level, and now they will get federal subsidies, and their payment goes down from $5,000 to $290 a year. So I think the federal subsidies are very generous.
Thank you very much.
And makes it affordable for people.
Thank you. DX, if you can give it a little hurry, because we're ending our program very shortly. So let's hear your question. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Etrice. How are you today? And I'm sorry, your guest name again, I'm sorry.
Vernelia Randall.
Vernelia Randall? Dr. Randall. Okay. I had a question. And thank you, Etrice, so much for having this brilliant lady on today, because even on progressive stations, there seems to be a lot of muddying up of the waters with all these issues, and they're not telling complete information. So I had a question regarding people who are right, like at the cutoff income to be subsidized. I heard something about $50,000 is where they cut it off or something like that. And I'm wondering about the people who are in the middle class who are, let's say, between 35 and 60,000. What's going to happen right in there with people who can't afford these prices for the insurance? And I know the level of subsidy is going to go down the more you make. So I'm concerned about that because I happen to fall in that area.
Thank you.
Well, I mean, I understand. If the subsidy isn't sufficient to cover your economic costs, that is definitely a problem. I mean,
right.
I don't know. That is a problem.
That is
promote universal health care and taxes that just takes care of it, because private insurance is just going to keep raising those premiums.
Right.
Or exactly. Cutting services. The other thing that private insurance is doing is they're limiting, and I've looked at, they're, in order to keep the premium down, they're limiting the panel of people that you can go to, which means that if there's a limited panel, you will have limited access, you know.
All right.
So you're trying to serve 100 people with three doctors. Well, that doctor's going to be overrun with business, limited panel, so you can't get in as quickly because the doctor just can't see you. That's
right.
What the insurance is doing, insurance companies are doing. They can't restrict you from going in, but if they limit the size of their panel, there just won't be availability. And I've heard that that's some of the things they're doing.
Well, we have to leave it there because we've come to
the
end of the program. Thanks so much, DX from Los Angeles, for your call.
Thank you.
Vernelia, I think we have to have about five more of these kinds of instructions from you as to how to think about this, because, you know, in the short time today, you've raised other issues and you've given us yet another layer of looking at this, and it is the layer of the intersection between race and class and historical lockouts in the area of healthcare disparities, glaring disparities, and the unwillingness, even within the progressive community, the African community, the Latino community, to just, you know, be open in their opposition and in their discontent with this administration. I think that's a really interesting thing. And, of course, believe it or not, you said something I've been talking about here for quite some time, the need to get out of these parties and start a party of your own. Fortunately, there was one party started just recently in New York, the Freedom Party, and we'll be talking more about that. So thanks so much for being here today, and we'll
Thank
set up
you
a time
for
inviting when you can, me. You could talk uninterrupted in a presentation of your own in the next a go around when you're here next with us. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you
now,
so much.
Stay tuned. Coming up next is Alternative Visions with Dr. Jack Rasmus, and let's be here again tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Bye bye.
Motion as it moves across the land, and the hands unclenched and open gives up life and love that brings. So keep your your hand wide open if you're